I'm Sophia Salaby. Welcome to special coverage from WKAR News as we honor Black History Month with a collection of stories and conversations highlighting the Black community in Michigan. COVID-19 has had a profound impact on the state's communities of color. Research has found during the first 4 months of the pandemic, the COVID death rate for African-American Michiganders was nearly 7 times higher than white ones. In September, the state's Coronavirus Task Force on Racial Disparities declared significant progress had been made in reducing the impact the disease has had on people of color. Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist heads up that task force. I spoke with him to discuss the continued work the group is doing, and I started by asking him when he was first alerted that COVID-19 was affecting more African-American Michiganders in more significant ways than white residents.
Our first case was on March 10th of 2020, but a month before that, in early February, our State Department of Health and Human Services, really under the leadership of our chief medical executive, Dr. Jonae Khaldun, anticipated that there may be visible disparities in how this virus showed itself in our state. And so she got to work even then after activating our state's emergency response center from a health emergency response center, got to work with local health departments and hospital systems to try to instrument their systems and processes to be able to collect demographic data that included race on COVID-19 deaths and cases, because the system was not set up to do that naturally. And so we were able to collect this data actually from the very beginning, and it only took a few weeks for it to become clear that this death rate was very, very significant and significantly different across communities of color, Black communities in our state. You know, to give you some perspective, Black folks, we make up 13.6% of the population in the state of Michigan, and we accounted for 41% of the deaths in March and in April. In those first few weeks after seeing this disparity and it being so deadly and recognizing that we needed to get to work now, there were people dying and we needed to try to intervene quickly. And that is why we pulled together this task force. The governor created it via executive order, asked me to be the chair, and I wanted it to be different, frankly, than other task forces. Sometimes a task force meets and, you know, get a lot of great minds together, you have meetings, and your output is a report with a set of recommendations. Well, this task force needed to be different because people were getting sick and dying every single day. So this task force had two charges: to one, to respond in real time to reduce the mortality rate of COVID-19. The second charge was to then, how do we connect the longer term work to reduce health disparities overall?
So it took about 6 months for the state to essentially close that gap. Can you tell me what strategies worked and what didn't to get us to that point?
The most important thing is that the state of Michigan decided to prioritize and center the experiences of some of the most vulnerable people and communities of color in the state of Michigan and had that be a core element of our state response. And frankly, that is something that strengthened our overall state response. And Michigan has been shown to be a leader in closing these racial disparities. And there were a number of interventions we did. On a basic level, we distributed more than 6 million masks for free across the state of Michigan, including 2 million child-sized masks, because the research showed that masks were a simple and effective way to slow the spread. We also invested in a communications campaign that was targeting our communities of color across the state of Michigan on radio, TV, but social media, print, and sort of ethnic publications and things like that, so people could know how important it was to follow the public health and public safety protocols, to wear your mask, to social distance. It was important to get tested, to know your COVID-19 status. And so we really worked to make sure that as we made testing more available and accessible, because it wasn't in a lot of communities of color, we created 21 neighborhood testing sites at community organizations across the state that were in the most hard hit areas of the state of Michigan. We declared racism a public health crisis. And part of that was to unlock, frankly, the potential for state government to examine all of its programs and systems and understand how racism and prejudice may have played a factor into their design and how that could be contributing to poor health outcomes or lower resilience in our communities. So working on these kinds of things, now we're sort of flipping that infrastructure to support vaccination. And so these are some of the interventions that led to those results that we saw in our interim report that we released, which showed that rather than representing 40% of the deaths in the first 2 months of the pandemic, in the last 3 months of 2020, Black folks represented less than 10% of the people who died of COVID-19, less than 9% of the cases. And so it's not any one intervention, it's the totality of the interventions that are the result of the focus of the state on centering communities of color that made a difference.
A recent study from the University of Michigan found that Black Michiganders with COVID-19 suffer worse health and socioeconomic outcomes than white residents with the disease. How are you taking on these new disparities that are starting to present themselves?
The increased vulnerability in terms of, for example, people of color being overrepresented in the types of professions that have been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic, like the service industry. For Black entrepreneurs whose businesses have been disproportionately negatively impacted because those may be businesses that were less likely to have the type of banking relationship that you needed to benefit from the Paycheck Protection Program, or have those kinds of existing relationships and may have been undercapitalized, which have made it difficult to survive during this pandemic. We've tried to design our state level responses to those economic supports, for example, to try to accommodate those and make sure that we have resources available specifically for these hard hit communities and hard hit areas. Recognizing that, again, this disparity goes beyond health, but that the pandemic didn't introduce us to these disparities. The pandemic has, if anything, exacerbated existing ones.
Garland Gilchrist is the state's lieutenant governor. He heads up the state's coronavirus task force on racial disparities. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Sophia. Everyone, please be safe.
You're listening to special coverage from WKAR News. I'm Sophia Salaby. During and after the 2020 election, many Democrats heralded Black women as the, quote, backbone of democracy. Their organizing efforts and support they galvanized was crucial to President Joe Biden's victory, as well as regaining Democratic power in the U.S. Senate. WKAR's Abigail Sensky has more on how Black women shaped an election year in Michigan.
All right, y'all. So I'm in Michigan again.
When Vice President Kamala Harris visited Detroit in September before the 2020 election, she was making a pitch to voters, notably Black voters, to make sure their networks voted too.
We will tell them that we were committed to making sure we vote and everyone we know votes, and in that way, fights for this country we love. Thank you, Detroit. Thank you.
Months later, when Harris gave her victory speech as the first woman and first Black and South Asian woman to hold the office of vice president, she gave a special shout out to the women who paved her way.
Including the Black women who are often, too often, overlooked, but so often prove they are the backbone of our democracy.
We've been taking our babies with us to vote. I mean, my mother and my grandmother both did it, and I do it. It's just part of who we are. We raise voters.
That was Lavora Barnes. Barnes is the first Black woman to serve as party chair in the state. Under her leadership, Michigan rejoined the so-called Blue Wall states when President Joe Biden won last year by a margin 14 times larger than former President Donald Trump's margin of victory in 2016. She says the power of Black women as an organizing force in Democratic politics is not new.
What is new is the attention on Black women. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we had a Black woman running for president and then vice president of the United States. A lot of that has to do with the fact that Black women have stepped up to lead in the party. I think there's just been more sound and fury, frankly, from Black women than there had been before.
Ronald Brown is an associate professor of political science at Wayne State University and a member of Citizen Detroit, a voter education group. He says the role of Black women in Detroit politics blooms out of places like Black churches and other religious meeting places.
They are the foundation in terms of mobilizing the vote. They're the ones who turn out in the meetings we attend. This is not a random sample, but the meeting that I attend, it's the same thing. It's like 66% women.
But in 2020, organizing during the coronavirus pandemic posed a challenge. Door knocking and community meetings weren't common, so a lot of voter outreach happened on social media. State Representative Sarah Anthony is the first Black woman to represent Lansing. She says she created a Facebook group for fellow members of Alpha Kappa Alpha to support their sorority sister, Kamala Harris.
In a matter of like 24 hours, there were thousands of women that signed up and said, I'm ready to go. What do we do? What are we wearing? You know, put me on a phone bank. I'll host something. I'll donate. And I mean, that level of political organization was just never truly captured, I don't think.
Organizers also connected with potential voters through virtual events.
Okay, so it says our meeting is now streaming live on Facebook. So for those of you that can see us, I would like to officially welcome you to Power in Politics. My name is Deshauna Robinson, and I am one of your moderators this evening.
Deshauna Robinson is a Black woman, a social worker, and member of the Benton Harbor Area School Board. She says she stepped up beyond voting this election cycle to take part in campaigning and donating after she realized she could play a more active role in recruiting voters.
A lot of the individuals within our community are starting to disconnect from their civil responsibility and connection to politics and kind of questioning how does it benefit us and why should we get involved? So I thought it would be best that I kind of step in and see what there was that I could do to kind of answer those questions and get that conversation started so that we each are aware that we do still need to be involved and connected.
Robinson says even the people who she wasn't able to convince to vote in 2020 were interested in following the Georgia Senate races and elections of Black women like Missouri Congresswoman Cori Bush and Vice President Harris.
I am very hopeful that we're headed in the right direction and that representation for ourselves and seeing the power that Stacey Abrams had in Georgia, seeing the VP in her seat rocking it out in her Chucks, I think all of those are things that will get individuals like myself and others motivated to see themselves as a part of that change.
The power of the 2020 election, part referendum on President Trump, and also the first opportunity to elect a Black woman to the second highest political office was fueled by a network of Black women like Robinson mobilizing other voters. In Lansing, I'm Abigail Sensky.
Thank you for joining us for WKAR special coverage of Black History Month. I'm Sophia Salaby. A new book is taking a unique approach to telling Black history stories for children. The photos that come with the book depict kids recreating well-known poses of these icons. And one of those kids is the grandson of co-author Rochelle Riley, who for many years was a columnist with the Detroit Free Press. WKAR Scott Pohl talked with Riley about the book called That They Lived, African Americans Who Changed the World.
To my eye, there are two methods at work here to attract young readers, and I want to talk about both of them. And first of all, the pictures. I want to make sure our listeners get the idea here that you've taken famous photos of famous African Americans, and they're seen side by side with the photos of the children who are reenacting those photos. I think that visual element will really appeal to kids.
That is my hope. The reason we did this project and the reason I wanted to do it was it's so important for all children, but particularly African American children, to know that they can be anything they want when they grow up, and that everybody they know, every famous person, every important person, was once a child facing some type of decision that might change their lives. And I thought by placing them in the shoes of these people when they were kids, and then telling their life story would help them to understand that. And of course, seeing it also helped. So, you know, seeing my grandson as Jackie Robinson or Muhammad Ali or Frederick Douglass was his favorite because of the hair. It really made a difference. It made them want to know more about these people.
The second way I think this book should appeal to kids is how in each story, you quickly tell us something about the childhood of all of these historic figures. And here are a couple of examples. Aretha Franklin was pregnant at the age of 12. Stevie Wonder was born prematurely and had a condition that stunted the growth of his eyes. Kids can identify with facts like that about the childhood of these people.
The main thing that I was looking for in my research was something that would give them a sense that you can overcome something, even if it's, you know, it can be something big or it can be a change in your life. I mean, for Jackie Robinson, he would grow up to be the first African-American to play Major League Baseball in the modern era. Huge, huge history changer, world changer. But when he was a 16-year-old high school student, he was a member of a gang. So I'm hoping there might be some kid who's contemplating being in a gang who could say, you know what, Jackie Robinson left the gang and look at what he was able to do. So that was important to find those moments, to find something that, you know, they could identify with. You know, Muhammad Ali, when he was Cassius Clay, his bike was stolen when he was 12. And he decided he was going to beat up the person who took it. And this officer who ran a boxing gym said, well, if you want to beat somebody up, you better learn how to do it. And he became singularly dedicated to that for the rest of his life, not beating up that kid who stole the bike, but just the idea of being a boxer. And that's how it got started. So you never know where your life's path will start.
Can you read me a segment from the book?
Oh, I would be honored to. One of my favorites and one of my favorite photographs is Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington is iconic band leader, musician, songwriter, and pianist who was just stunning, you know, how long his career was. And his picture was this amazing one of him sitting at the piano in a really great suit, that famous smile that everybody knows. So my grandson got to wear a mustache and sit at the piano the exact same way in his Sunday suit. And it was wonderful. And the beginning of that chapter, as the beginning of every chapter is, starts this way. Edward Kennedy Duke Ellington would grow up to be one of the most celebrated musicians and composers in history. He is considered one of the founding fathers of American jazz. But when Edward was 15 years old, he was serving sodas at the counter at the Poodle Dog Cafe and writing his first composition called Soda Fountain Rag. And he did it before learning to read or write music. And every single essay starts that way. I find a moment that hits between those ages of 9 and 15 so that kids 9 to 15 can see themselves.
The book is That They Lived, African Americans Who Changed the World. It's available wherever you buy books. Rochelle Riley is the co-author of the book. You may remember her for many years as a columnist in the Detroit Free Press. Rochelle is now Director of Arts and Culture for the City of Detroit. Rochelle Riley, thank you so much. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. And people can go to RochelleRiley.com to get any information they need about me or the book.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Pohl.
You're listening to WKAR special coverage of Black History Month. I'm Sophia Salaby. Though Detroit's historic Black Bottom neighborhood may be physically gone, author Alice Randall resurrects the energy and life of the Black center of the city in her 2020 novel, Black Bottom Saints. The book is in part inspired by a traditional Catholic Saints Day book that's as each short chapter commemorates a Black American, some that are well-known and some that are relatively unknown, who touched or was touched by the neighborhood in the mid-20th century. Ziggy Johnson is the narrator of her novel. He is known for founding the Ziggy Johnson School of the Theater that catered to young Black children. He was a club MC and columnist with the Michigan Chronicle. Alice Randall first explained why she chose him as the voice of the Black Bottom neighborhood for her novel.
Well, his dance school, the Ziggy Johnson School of the Theater, was the heart of a part of Black Detroit. And it was the place where the 122,808 Black girls who were living in Detroit, according to the 1960 census, gathered most intimately with me. So Ziggy was in so many different worlds. I loved him and I wanted to honor him. I thought he deserved a memorial.
And you also, as you've kind of mentioned, you knew the real Ziggy Johnson when you were a child. What was your process to bring his voice to the page?
I say this is the book that took me 50 years of living and a decade of writing to construct. It was 7 years of hard research, starting with archival materials, scrolling through microfilm in the basement of a library at Vanderbilt, and then following up with reading through hundreds of African-American newspapers, then interviewing people, and also reading full book-length manuscripts. Just wild.
Is there a particular memory of him that sticks out in your mind?
Father's Day, Youth Colossal. Once a year, there was a giant pageant at something called the Latin Quarter. And this was such an important pageant that people, including the Supremes, Sammy Davis, the Mills Brothers, would get involved. But children in the city of Detroit would be involved. And I participated in the Youth Colossal in 64 and 65. And we have to understand that it was a cross between a W.E.B. Du Bois pageant and a children's recital. It was something that had to do with play therapy. It had something to do with history. It was an important place. The entire community came together. So Ziggy backstage and Ziggy getting us ready to take our place on a stage with as adults as significant voices, that's my biggest memory of Ziggy.
You chose to accompany each chapter with a paired specialty cocktail. How did you come up with that idea?
The book takes as one of its major themes, joy is radical. But it is situated also in the movement from trauma to transcendence for people, period, but Black people specifically. I loved including the cocktails because they are five scents addressed to joy. The touch, the taste, the sight, the sound, the scent of joy. And the cocktails also connect us to Thomas Bullock, one of the saints, and they connect us to Ziggy's Catholicism. And so the form takes something from both of those traditions, the Saint's Day book or hagiography form and the cocktail recipe book form.
There's something you said there, trauma to transcendence. It's something I've heard you mention a few times in interviews. Can you tell me more about how this became a central theme of your book?
More than half of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence owned slaves. So in the fabric of the founding is Black trauma of being bought, sold, and as we now know, frequently raped and worked. So all Americans have to move from trauma to transcendence, from the trauma in the fabric of the founding. When I was starting to write this book, it was in the rise of the Me Too movement, the rise of the Say Her Name movement, and the rise of the Black Lives movement. All of these speak out to historic, more recent trauma. Just to speak for a moment about Say Her Name, Tanya Blanding, who's the saddest saint, she is a little girl who was shot down in her home in the summer of 1967, her home in Detroit, by a Michigan State policeman. You don't get to move from trauma to transcendence if you get shot down in your home at 4 years old. But we must all try to figure out how to rise from the ashes of that trauma, just as today we all have to figure out how to rise from the ashes of COVID.
This book is centered on Black Detroit, but I really found it to be about the Black America of the mid-20th century as Ziggy Johnson weaves through the civil rights movement, sports legends, and cultural icons. Why was it important for you to focus on Detroit rather than these places like Chicago's Bronzeville and New York's Harlem that many of these saints also interacted with at around the same time?
I actually think that Detroit in the mid-20th century was the epicenter of Black art, activism, athletics, and industry. Notably in Detroit, what Detroit had, among other things that Bronzeville and Harlem didn't have, was the Gotham Hotel. Langston Hughes himself called the Gotham the number one Negro hotel in the world. So it was delightful to come to the Gotham and not just stay in this hotel, but to see the Black art on the walls. Artist Lane will have her portraits of Black Detroiters and others on those walls. And today she has a sculpture in Biden's Oval Office. So it wasn't just one kind of art of dance and song that we associated with Detroit, but it was a variety of arts. Why? Because what did also Detroit have? The breadwinners. These are the Black men and women who worked in Mr. Ford's and other factories doing this very boring factory work. It prepared them when they got off to want to do something interesting, like engage with art. So Detroit had this empowered Black audience, because the third part of what was different about Detroit and the arts is in Harlem and in Bronzeville. If you were a Black person, you likely perhaps lived in a home, apartment, or house that was owned by white people. And when you went out to the fancy great clubs, you were going to clubs, even if Black people were performing, that they did not own. In Detroit, at one point, we have 80% Black home ownership. And we also have an extraordinary number of Black-owned bars, taverns, clubs, so that Black art got to thrive by an all-Black art aesthetic. That was the difference of Detroit, was the fire of the breadwinners as audience.
To finish this conversation, it's February. We're kind of reaching a year of living in this pandemic. Is there a saint that you are particularly reflecting on in this time?
One of the saints that I love is Sadie Pryor. She's a librarian. She's a woman who wears her little Black dress and her pearls, but she goes behind the scenes And she argues with racist legislatures to get lifeguards for the Black beaches. A legislature is only as good as the people lobbying it and the witness they bring. We see all the front page people who are involved in politics, but Sadie Pryor reminds us that some of the most important education doesn't happen in the schoolroom or classroom, it happens in the library. And some of the most important politics happens when church ladies with pearls wearing a black dress go in and witness their truth to power behind the scenes, and someone actually listens.
Alice Randall is a novelist. She wrote the book Black Bottom Saints. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for being here to celebrate. Joy is radical, love is the strut, and hate is the stumble. And on that note, I wish everyone an extraordinary and joyful end of Black History Month.
Thank you for joining us for special coverage of 2021's Black History Month. For the rest of the WKAR News team, I'm Sophia Salaby.